Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio KC. On tonight's program, Ann Solentrup and Richard Mabian discuss the conference Ann attended in St. Louis this past weekend, The Atoms Next Door. But first, I'm naturally with your headline news. MidtownKCPost.com reports, the Prospect Max, a much-requested transit improvement in the urban core, has taken another step forward. President Barack Obama's administration is recommending $29.9 million for a new bus rapid transit line on Prospect Avenue, the region's second busiest transit corridor, according to the Kansas City Area Transportation Authority, or KCATA. The city has been planning for the enhanced bus service, which would need funds from the federal government, the city, and the KCATA. The federal dollars recommended by the president would be the largest source of money for the $54 million project. The president's recommendation still needs to be approved by Congress. Councilman Jermaine Reed, who chaired the Prospect Max Advisory Committee, said a new bus rapid transit line will prove to be a transformative movement for Prospect Avenue. Quote, millions of dollars of investment is occurring in the Prospect Corridor, end quote, Reed said in a news release. Quote, improved public transportation will both catalyze and capitalize on the area's revitalization. New bus service will be a defining moment for this important part of Kansas City, end quote. The KCATA said U.S. Representative Emmanuel Cleaver and the Missouri Congressional Delegation, Kansas City Mayor Sly James, and Councilman Reed have been instrumental in moving the project forward. The bus service already has rapid transit lines on Troost Avenue and Main Street, which are popular with riders. ClimateCentral.org reports, there was a huge global spike in one of the most potent greenhouse gases driving climate change over the last decade, and the U.S. may be the biggest culprit, according to a new Harvard University study. The United States alone could be responsible for between 30% and 60% of the global growth in human-caused atmospheric methane emissions since 2002 because of a 30% spike in methane emissions across the country, the study says. The research shows that emissions increased the most in the middle of the country, but the author said there is too little data to identify specific sources. However, the increase occurred at the same time as America's shale oil and gas boom, which has been associated with large amounts of methane leaking from oil and gas wells and pipelines nationwide. Quote, I'd say the biggest takeaway is that there is more we, the U.S., could be doing to reduce our methane emissions to combat climate change, end quote, study lead author Alex Turner, a Harvard University chemical engineering PhD candidate, said. The Aliso Canyon gas leak in California, which was plugged last week after a nearly four-month effort to contain it, has brought new attention to methane. The gas is roughly 86 times as potent as carbon dioxide as a driver of climate change over a period of 20 years, or 35 times as potent over the span of a century. The Aliso leak spewed enough methane into the atmosphere to equal the greenhouse gases emitted by more than 440,000 cars in a year. DemocracyNow.org reports, Flint residents are forced to drink, cook with, and even bathe in bottled water while still paying some of the highest water bills in the country for their poisoned water. In 2001 and 2002, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality issued permits to Nestle, the largest water bottling company in the world, to pump up to 400 gallons of water per minute from aquifers that feed Lake Michigan. This sparked a decade-long legal battle between Nestle and the residents of Mecosta County, Michigan, where Nestle wells are located. In Mecosta County, Nestle is not required to pay anything to extract the water, besides a small permitting fee to the state and the cost of leases to a private landowner. In fact, the company received $13 million in tax breaks from the state to locate the plant in Michigan. The spokesperson for Nestle in Michigan is Deborah Muchmore. She's the wife of Dennis Muchmore, Governor Rick Snyder's chief of staff, who just retired and registered to be a lobbyist. Amy Goodman spoke with Peggy Case, Terry Swire, and Glenna Manick of Michigan Citizens for Water Conservation on February 17th. You can find a link to this interview on our Eco Radio Facebook page. At this time, I would like to introduce Mr. Richard Mabian.
Good evening, everyone. This is Richard Mabian again. It's 2 weeks in a row. I'm starting to get used to this. It's feeling pretty good. The weather's nice. We're sitting around with spring-like weather. Will it get cold again or will it not? That's the big question. I was talking to some community garden folks this week, and they say their phone is ringing off the hooks because people are ready. People are ready. It's that, I know, I guess having weather like this makes you feel like it's time. So, but everybody out there, hold your horses. We'll figure out what's going on and where we're going from here. I'm sure I just have a fond belief that there's another one of them cold spells going to hit us. Whatever it is, it's not going to last that long, so we on the downhill slope now anyhow. Glad to be here. As usual, there's so much going on in this country. I say this all the time, but this is such a fantastic time to be involved in the environmental and conservation world. There's some good, there's some bad, there's some ugly, but the main thing is that people are starting to catch on to the fact that there's something that they need to be doing. When we talk about individual responsibility, I see that it's becoming more and more an issue. I was here last week talking about the diesel emission project, and I know y'all heard my comments from that. I love it when I'm out there walking around the city as a semi-celebrity. I'll call myself that. Oh, wow, yeah, you got to hear this. I hate bragging on myself. But yours truly and Margaret May was tricked into showing up out at the EPA office this week, and they had this big program going on in conjunction with Black History Month, and they presented Margaret May and I as the EJ persons of the year, and they gave us a proclamation for environmental justice that was signed by none other than Barack Obama. So I have a Barack Obama signed a proclamation in my house. I was going to carry it around and show it off to folks and stuff, but I've had a tendency not to do it. But I would tell you all, because y'all my family and I wanted you to be aware of it. I don't know exactly what that means or where we go with it, but you knowing me, if I got that designation for this year, I'm going to try to use it as best I can and bring our kind of environmental justice concern to the forefront. When I was out there, I want everyone up there in St. Louis to know I talked about that continuous fire you got going on up there and how concerned I was about that. So we need more people that are able to get to the source and be able to talk to people directly about the concerns that we as citizens have. So just wanted you to be aware of it. So if you riding across town and see my face on the billboard, you'll know why. Now we're going to get ready for our show tonight. I have what I like to consider one of my favorite friends here with me. This young lady and I met at, I believe it was for real, at my first Breaking the Silence conference. We may have met each other before. And she was there giving out, if I never forget, she was giving out CFLs, giving out light bulbs. Yeah, I mean, that, of all the things that she does, that's what she was sitting there doing, giving out light bulbs. And from there, we have grown to be quite, I like to say, responsible environmentalists in this town. I'm sitting here with Ann Sullenthorpe. How are you doing, Ann?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
This is it's always a pleasure for me to be sitting in the same room with you and getting ready to engage in some conversation about some environmental issue or concern. Before we get into your trip next week, last week, I want to get into you here for a second. Who are you? Who are you working for? At one point, weren't you with the social responsibility folks?
Yes, I'm working with Physicians for Social Responsibility, the Kansas City chapter, and I'm also on the Peace Works board.
Okay. Now, I saw some article in the paper the other day that had you with some ANA group or something.
Right. There's a network of over 30 organizations nationwide, and it's called Alliance for Nuclear Accountability.
Okay.
And it's been going for decades, and it really holds the federal government accountable for the nuclear weapons production and the waste created by it.
Well, and when I talk about celebrities, you by far, I really feel I'm sitting with an environmental celebrity right now because of your role and the things that you've been involved in. You're a front page issue. I mean, your name shows up all the time, and I just want to let you know that I'm really excited and glad to know you. I think the things that you do is proof positive that you're the kind of folks that we need in this world, in this country,
yeah,
and in our city.
This is a topic that is very much under the radar most of the time.
Right.
It has been from the very beginning. It's a very secretive industry, and it's also very wasteful of our tax dollars. Trillions of dollars have gone into nuclear weapons, and it's something we're not even going to use.
Right.
And meanwhile, it's polluting our water, our land, our air, and it's killing our own people.
You know, that's it's just so discouraging to me. Because of all the work that we do to consider ourselves working to benefit mankind, you know, women, men, children, as far as the food that they eat, the air that they breathe, and all of these things we talk about. But when I get around someone like you and Maurice and y'all start talking about the reality of what these corporations are doing, it's just...
Right. It's not about the jobs.
Yeah.
It's about the money.
Yeah.
It's about the big money.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's a shame because they live in the same world. I mean, what are they... Mm-hmm. Well, I think kind of that thing up in Flint. I mean, we allow things to go by without really giving it a lot of attention. But when you had a state agency that was providing bottled water for their people, while at the same time the people they represent was drinking that crap. That's letting you know that the people that's in it for the money have a way of taking care of their own.
Mm-hmm.
You
that
know
stuff
what?
Went on here at the Kansas City plant. I was told that the higher ups got bottled water.
Got bottled water.
That's right.
All right, let's hear about this session you went to last week.
Well, I got to be with one of my sheroes, and that was Dr. Caldicott, Dr. Helen Caldicott. She has been speaking out against nuclear waste and nuclear energy and nuclear weapons for decades. And she lives in Australia now. She's a pediatrician, and I'm a pediatric nurse.
Okay.
So I have something in common. And she talked, she was the headliner of it, and then they had a panel. They also had an art exhibit. It was outstanding, a photography exhibit. And they had some elected officials from their county to end up and say, well, what are they doing about this mess?
Their county, St. Louis County?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
All right.
So the symposium was called The Adams Next Door. It took place on Saturday, February 20th.
Okay.
And Helen Caldicott broke down the health science involved in this, and she went through how uranium has a long, long half-life. You might as well say it's with us forever. And then she broke it down into what it decays into. And it was a whole series. I think it was like 20 different items there. Thorium was one of them. That has a half-life of thousands of years. It's still radioactive after thousands of years. Radium, you know, very deadly. You know, Joanna Macy calls it poison fire. And that's what it is. And we're making this stuff, and we should leave it in the ground.
Okay, here we go again, talking about a subject that just seems to be so dismal.
Well, you know what they say, when you're digging a hole, stop digging. You know, that's the first
but
thing.
But the point about it, they're not. You folks out there listening, if any of you want, I'd love for people to call in if you want to. I'm going to make it available to you. Because this is not about Ann and I, it's about us as a community having a discussion about what's going on in life. So if you have a question or something you'd like to add to it, I appreciate you giving us a call. Our number is 816-931-5534. Okay, so who put this on in St. Louis?
Well, this was put on by the St. Louis Community College, the Wildwood Branch. And they're starting a series of Making Knowledge Human. And so I like that.
Making Knowledge Human,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Bringing it down to our level.
Okay.
And it was a symposium on nuclear waste and occupational illness. And another prominent person was there, Kay Dry. And she has been active in Missouri working against nuclear energy. And she's the reason, probably the main reason, why we don't have Callaway energy plant number 2. They got one, but But they
were wanting to build a second plant in Missouri.
Right, and she stopped it. Okay. And she is affiliated with Missouri Coalition for the Environment. And so you can find that on the internet if you want to. But then Bob Alvarez also talked, and he was in the Department of Energy in the 90s, and he actually helped set up the environmental management part of the bomb building enterprise. And you, when you look at the federal budget, almost all of the money goes to making nuclear weapons. Very, very little goes to cleaning it up. And that's why I'm worried about the Kansas City plant here in town. Are the feds really going to clean it up, or are they going to walk away?
Yeah, I think my feelings for the plant here in town reached this cutoff when they built a child care facility on top of some of that possible content, toxic stuff. And nobody really said that much about it. That bothered me.
That's the way it goes. Deny, right. Cover it up. Right. You know, oh, nothing to see here. Keep moving.
You know, I say this a lot, y'all, when I'm on the air and I talk about David Corton and his book, The Great Turning. And one thing I learned from David was that this collapse for this planet is inevitable. And as we said and talked, that's the only conclusion that I can possibly get is the road to recovery is going to be after the collapse. Because that's the only, because they're not stopping. I mean, talking to people, they're not stopping. I mean, and even after that collapse, it's going to be a select group of people that's still going to be alive. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got ground burning up there in St. Louis now.
That's right. It's called the Westlake Landfill. And first of all, what started this off was there was a very, very, very rich area in the Congo that had just almost naturally occurring highly enriched uranium. And this Belgian company extracted that, and they was brought to St. Louis to process to make the very first nuclear reactions and the bombs over Nagasaki, I believe. Could have been Hiroshima, too.
Yeah.
But when they had all this waste left over from processing it in St. Louis, they dumped it illegally by the airport. And then it was moved again and again throughout different areas. And so one of those areas is the Westlake Landfill, 43,000 tons. And right next to it is another landfill of regular trash, and it's on fire. And it's moving towards the radioactive stuff.
Yeah, that's serious.
That's crazy.
That's serious stuff. And it makes you wonder why in this day and age of politics, elections and stuff like this, how, especially with the emphasis being placed on environmental and conservation issues, why none of this stuff is being mentioned. It's kind of scary. First of all, how did St. Louis become the hub for nuclear whatever?
I couldn't answer that. It was a company that said, hey, we'll do it, you know.
Is it so, the company? Or,
yeah,
or
Mollenkrodt
Company.
It's
not that they have the ideal circumstances and climates and soil and that kind of mess?
No. It was a company right down in St. Louis, the city. And so it outgrew, you know, all that waste started piling up, so they had to dump it somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
And so they dumped it in a place called Coldwater Creek also. And the ladies, I stayed with the lady activist up there. She's a nurse also, Sue Foley. And she talked about she used to live right up by Coldwater Creek, okay? And the creek flooded her basement. And they didn't know. Nobody had told them. So it was probably all radioactive in her basement. And that's where her daughter's bedroom was. And she now has leukemia. Mm. She's had it for 10 years. And another lady that spoke has also lived at the end of the street right by Coldwater Creek. Mary was her name. I didn't catch her last name. She has the worst level of lung cancer there is. I mean, she's going to die probably.
You know, I'm going to put this number out again, y'all. 816-931-5534. 816-931-5534. And the reason I'm doing that, you know, when you have people like us sitting here, we're so directly involved in and over the edge. And sometimes I think maybe we look at it from a different perspective. But I'd like to know from just one of you regular guys, one of the regular guys and gals out there, how when you hear this, how it makes you feel. I want to know how the public is reacting to these comments and these circumstances that we keep bringing up. This is real close to home.
Well, yeah, and
we had a fire.
The moms in St. Louis are all up in arms because all of a sudden this fire started in 2010.
Right.
Nobody told anybody.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they came up with this emergency plan of what to do when that explosion of radioactive material hits the air and makes a plume over the whole region. And they said, well, your kids are going to have to shelter in the school. And we got to send your kids medicines so we can give them their medicines at the school. And
so
the moms
keep them in the school.
Yeah, and the moms went crazy. They had the Facebook page now. It has about 18,000 people on it, and there's a couple different groups of moms.
Well, again, like I'm saying, it's I just don't know. It just doesn't like seem like we're getting the response and reaction that you think would happen when we hear that stuff. It makes me wonder: are we the conspiracy theorists or whatever?
Well,
that we
just
take
like
it
here in Kansas
level?
City, I mean, they used to. Westinghouse used to run the Kansas City plant. They told people that they were making wash machines. So, I mean, there it's a cover up.
And
a lot, you know,
boy.
A lot of confusion, and it's not really all that dangerous. Don't worry, you know, but people need to know there's a few activists out there digging into the dirt and really trying to bring the light on what's going on.
So from your perspective, what would you want to see occur?
Well, they have some of the area is being already cleaned up, and that's being done, they feel like, in a good way by FUSRAP, and that is a program by called Formerly Utilized Sites Remedial Action Program. It's the Army Corps of Engineers.
So clean up. When you say clean up, what do you mean?
Yeah.
What are they doing to clean it up?
Well, they have to dig up the soil.
And do what?
And dispose of it in another place.
Well, see, that's my concern, because I go out there. I went through the environmental law class with EPA, and they gave us two plots of land to use as our test for our test. One of them was Garland Park over in Wyandotte County, and the other one was that old Shuffield plant that was out there in Argentine. Mm-hmm. And from what I gather, they dug up 6 foot of contaminated soil and moved it up to the end and piled it up in a pile there on the ground. They did not remove it. They piled it up on the ground, and then they came back and dumped 6 foot of dirt on top of it. Same
mm-hmm.
thing at Garland mm-hmm. Park. So that to me, that's not a cleanup. That's kind of like a cover-up
mm-hmm,
more than it
mm-hmm.
is a cleanup. But so I don't mm-hmm. wonder where if they're digging that dirt up, where are they taking it?
They would have to bury it in a way that would not leak into the ground, and that would have to be in a lined or a concrete or a tank or some kind of way of containing it. But, I mean, there's no denying we are polluting ourselves.
There's no cleanup. It's just
just
delay.
Put it away from people, but it's going to last forever.
Yeah.
So we need to quit making it.
Yeah.
But at least remove it from where the people are living right now. And the thing is, it's hard to prove that the radioactivity caused X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, well, that's always the issue.
Yeah.
You can't
and
prove it.
It's a latent period from 4 to 80 years.
Right.
So, and then by that time, people have moved to other states. And then when they die of a disease, they don't know that it was because they were at Coldwater Creek. And so that's what Mary was talking about. When she dies, she wants it tracked to Coldwater Creek. So that it shows, it proves, you know,
well,
yes.
I guess I'm just trying to figure out how can we factor these things into a person's life expectancy. How does it become an issue in our county? It has to be that way somewhere down the line because we're not working to eliminate it. Mm-hmm. We're not working to eliminate it. Even when you move it, we're not eliminating it. We're just moving it to another spot. Mm-hmm. It's kind of scary. I'm going to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I just think it's a conversation that the American public needs to have.
Well, they had the School of Journalism in Columbia, Missouri had a thing for journalists about a month ago. And they had people from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission there and the NEIA. It's like for the industry of nuclear energy. They had then the other side beyond nuclear was there, and that's a spokesperson called Kevin Camps. And he was just bringing out fact after fact about how dangerous it is. And the other side was just trying to say, oh, no, there's no evidence, blah, blah, blah.
That's what I'm saying. Your climate deniers or the people who won't take this for real. I mean, it's just, you know, you grow up and you have this true belief that, you know, you have watchdogs out there that are looking out for your betterment. Looking out for the betterment of mankind.
And, they're essential.
And it's just
absolutely
not
necessary.
It's not happening, you know, and because we see things that continue. It's just like when they go in the meat plant and find out they've been dropping food on the floor. Some restaurant here in town got busted last week with people not washing their hands. I think I'm not going to mention the restaurant for fear of getting pimp slapped or something on a lawsuit. But, I mean, you know, the founding employees not washing their hands and just different things that's causing disease to be transferred from one place to another. You know, what are we missing? I mean, what is happening in our education process in this country that we're not reaching people's psychic about those kinds of circumstances and issues? What are we doing wrong?
Well, that's what me and you did for several years in a row there. You had that Breaking the Silence conference, and that's what we have to do. We have to break the silence.
Yeah.
We have to listen to the whistleblowers and the people, support the people that are trying to do the job of holding this, well, the federal government accountable. Because the federal government is responsible. They're the ones that made the mess. They need to clean it up, just like here in Kansas City.
Well, you know.
And Kansas City is trying to turn it over to a private company, CenterPoint, and have them clean up the Kansas City plant.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it just seems like you elect officials from your governor to your mayors to your city councilman, whatever you call them in the various municipalities that we have. And those are the people who are supposed to be representing your interests.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people who are supposed to be taking a stance. I think the mayor of Kansas City, Kansas, the most beloved person it seems that we have, should be taking a stance on these issues and causes that's going on not only here but it's going on around the state. I mean, I heard that what's her name? What's our congresswoman from senator from Missouri from Kansas?
Senator McCaskill. McCaskill from Missouri.
Just heard today that she has breast cancer.
Really?
And just came out today, and she's having to take time off from Congress. But I mean, they have laid out her circumstances real well, you know, how that she's going to be telling people what she would have voted if she had been voting. In other words, they making an issue out of that. But here we are sitting up with stuff that is killing people.
Literally,
killing people.
Making them sick. Weird cancers, too.
And we don't know nothing about it.
Cancers of the appendix. You ever heard of that?
Oh, no. There's
a whole cluster of them right by Coldwater Creek. I never heard of that.
Never heard of it.
No.
And as usual, we never have enough time to do what we need to do, but we are doing what we're supposed to do, and that's being responsible and explaining to the American public what's going on.
That's what it'll take.
We can't do any more than that, and I really appreciate you coming in.
Mm-hmm.
You have anything closing you'd like to give us?
I know my colleague Jay Coughlin, our president of ANA, he always says democracy is a muscle. Use it or lose it.
Use it or lose it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, gang. Well, I really I hope you got something out of what we were doing and what we was talking about. As usual, we're cutting edge. We're going to bring it to you and make you aware of it, and you'll hear things here that you can't hear other places. We're going to stop and take a break. We'll be back with you in just a second.
Tuesday at 6 p.m., Radioactive Magazine explores climate change issues with guest Andy Knott, senior campaign representative for the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. Andy Knott and host David Mitchell will discuss the Obama administration's clean power plan designed to reduce coal plant emission by over 30% and the effect that the Supreme Court stay on the implementation of the clean power plan will have on the environment. We'll also discuss the state of alternative energy in the state of Missouri. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. As coal and tar sands become riskier sources of energy, are they still worthwhile investments? The University of California does not think so. The massive 10-school system recently sold $200 million worth of stocks it had in coal and tar sand companies. Amy Myers Jaffe, a senior investment advisor for energy and sustainability at the University of California system, says the disinvestment was simply a sound financial decision.
I think it was a very straightforward decision. I'm surprised that more universities didn't follow our lead. It's very hard to make a case today as an investor that you're going to be profitable in holding, especially in the United States, coal mining companies.
The university cited slowing global demand and growing environmental concerns as contributing factors. But much of its endowment is still invested in funds with more diverse fossil fuel holdings. A student-led movement is demanding that the university system go further and divest from all fossil fuels. But for now, the University of California's decision to disinvest is solely market-driven. Meanwhile, the university is investing in other green initiatives, including $1 billion in climate solutions, and pledging to become carbon neutral in just 9 years. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
There's a place in southeast Colorado just above the New Mexico border called Bon Carbo. The name is a loose translation of the French bon charbon, meaning good coal.
Good coal makes sense because this area in the foothills of the Spanish Peaks is loaded with the stuff, as in mother load. Back in the early 1900s, Bon Carbo and the Raton Basin were a huge and thriving coal mining area.
We're seeing remnants of the coke ovens as Franny and I drive west from Trinidad on State Highway 12. Mining operations are long gone after demand fell in the late 1950s, and things stayed pretty quiet for decades.
That is until about 20 years ago when gas exploration came to the area in a big way. By some estimates, there are about 2,000 gas wells in the Raton, to the tune of about one well for every 40 acres today.
Bringing along with it heavy traffic, noise, and what many locals believe, contaminated drinking water from drilling into the coal formation to extract natural gas.
So for those who move to Bon Carbo for the peace and quiet, not to mention clean air and water, good coal? Not so much. Just ask Carol Vanderwall.
Yeah, I'm Franny. That's Jamie.
We meet Carol at her house, nestled in a pine forest valley. Her dog, Jace, is jumping up, excited at our arrival.
Carol's a thin woman in her early 80s. She and her husband, now deceased, moved to Bon Carbo from Denver 40 years ago and raised a family in this very spot. She's seen a lot of change.
Well, there wasn't any activity for a long, long time. They had not done anything until the early 90s, and then there was activity, and Amoco was the player then, and they sold to Evergreen. So Evergreen just had their way with this land, just drilled everywhere. Hundreds of wells.
To say that Evergreen, or more formally the Evergreen Operating Corporation's time in this area was contentious, that would be gross understatement.
A small amount of us pressed suit against Evergreen. They were in violation of the Clean Water Act.
Carol and her neighbors alleged Evergreen was illegally discharging produced water from coal bed methane drilling into nearby arroyos. The lawsuit was settled, and they were even honored with a Friend of EPA award for fighting water pollution. It was a victory, until it wasn't.
It was like having cancer. You know, first you have encouraging results, and then you're down on the bottom again. And it was something that was not fun. In fact, Evergreen did a slap suit against us.
A so-called slap suit is short for strategic lawsuits against public participation. It's a tactic used by companies to discourage citizens from taking direct action. The slap suit against Carol and fellow landowners charged them with trespassing and libel. The libel portion was dismissed, and the trespass portion, where they crossed onto private property to photograph violations, was settled in July 2000.
Mention Evergreen to landowners here, and many shiver as though recalling a disturbing nightmare. The drilling company has since been sold to Pioneer Natural Resources, and most say Pioneer has been a better neighbor. But still, all is not bone in Bon Carbo.
I got the gold medal, I got the gold ring, or yeah. Whatever.
She's referring to her latest water analysis that reads like a witch's brew of chemicals.
And you also have benzene, and I can't pronounce all these other zines.
Chlorine and, all of those hard words.
Carol had asked the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, or COGCC, to sample her water because a previous test had shown benzene, toluene, and increasing methane. Carol, like other homeowners we interviewed, had baseline testing, so she knew that her water had changed.
I called Peter because I wanted him to test the water in 2014 because I wanted to find out if pollutants had actually gone down.
She's referring to Peter Gintatis, COGCC's Environmental Protection Specialist for Southeast Colorado at the time. He came out to sample her well.
And that's when he got excited and said, oh my gosh, we got TBA. That's not naturally occurring.
He said that? Peter?
Not sure.
Oh, I'm sorry, I interrupted. Yeah. Go ahead and say
yeah.
it.
I was going to say, Peter Gintatis told you that TBA is not naturally occurring.
Yeah, he told me that.
TBA is short for tert butyl alcohol. You might not have heard of TBA, but it's in lots of things you use every day, like shampoos, nail polish, and perfumes.
And also in shellac, paint removers, and was a byproduct of gasoline additives.
One place it shouldn't be found? In water wells.
So we're surprised to hear Carol's answer, because just last year, Peter, on behalf of the COGCC, investigated the incidence of TBA in the Raton Basin and published a report strongly suggesting the opposite, that people had tert butyl alcohol in well water because it was naturally occurring.
I'll tell you what Peter told me about TBA when he first found it. He said, no one's done any testing on how this affects the human body. But there was a testing in North Carolina or South Carolina where they've tested male rats and come to the conclusion that it does something to the urinary tract and gives liver cancer and such. So that kind of caught me up short. I've been drinking this. So, okay, I guess I better go for some clean water.
So what are you doing now for drinking water?
I go to town and get 5 gallons at a time from a reverse osmosis place.
But are you using the water for anything from the wells?
I'm using it for bathing and for washing dishes, clothes, that sort of thing.
Did he tell you anything like, I think you should talk to the Department of Health?
No.
I suggest you shouldn't drink this water?
No, he never said that.
He never told you not to drink your water?
No.
This was just a decision you made on your own?
Well, yeah, after being alarmed that everybody else is not drinking their water, and I'm saying, oh my gosh, mine is even worse, so.
Not only did Carol not get any direction about her water, it took COGCC 5 months to send her the results.
Are you going to have them come back and test again?
Yeah, I suspect I will.
Just have to do another complaint?
Evidently, I do. At this point, I'm just up to here with, I can't contain it all. But you'd think that they would come back and test it on their own, maybe even.
Carol Vanderwall is not at all alone in feeling like the agency in charge of regulating oil and gas activity in the state of Colorado is not in her corner. We interviewed other homeowners who had changes to their water, and COGCC refused to link it to gas drilling, even though it's the only industry in the area.
From past dealings, COGCC is not really on the side of the landowner. That's been our experience. So I don't trust them. The people that work for them, I think they tell them, that I'm talking about the industry, they tell them just what they want them to know so that they can feed the landowner just what the landowner should know. And so you have no knowledge of their drilling techniques, especially with Evergreen. That was sad. It's not been easy. It's not been easy dealing with the industry or COGCC.
As good-natured as Carol is, she is clearly fed up with the state and its seeming unwillingness to regulate the industry.
I hear all this scuttlebutt about them not affecting the groundwater, and that's just a blatant lie. I'm sorry, it is just a blatant lie.
It should be noted that the last time COGCC communicated with her was in a letter stating that the sources of the volatile organic compounds in her water wells was, quote, unknown at this time, adding that the investigation of her complaint was ongoing.
That was August of 2014, a year and a half ago, and she's not heard a peep since. Forgotten, it would seem.
In part two of our story, we'll try to find out if COGCC is going to investigate Carol's water. We'll also try to talk to them about their report on TBA in the Raton Basin.
We asked geologists, hydrologists, and other scientists to review it, and, spoiler alert, they came to a different conclusion. Reporting from Denver, Colorado, I'm Franny Halperin.
And I'm Jamie Sudler, and you're listening to H2O Radio.
Families of the dying are often caught between the hope of not giving up too soon and the hope of not prolonging suffering. Dr. Anne Allegre is an early developer of hospice care in Kansas City and has received a national prize for excellence in end-of-life care. She will offer her experience in hospice and palliative care to help us understand how we can make more appropriate decisions in these difficult circumstances. Coming up this Wednesday, 6 p.m. on the All Souls Forum right here on KKFI.
Steps you can take to get the lead out of your tap water. On this Current Cast. In homes with decades-old plumbing systems, lead can leach into water from failing or corroded pipes. At levels potentially present in drinking water, lead is tasteless and odorless, so you will not detect it on your own. To protect your health, if you have old plumbing, collect the water that first comes out of the tap for things like watering plants. That's the water that's been sitting in the pipes. Then, fill and store several containers in the fridge to drink later. Cook with cold tap water, too, since hot is more likely to pick up lead. Even if you follow these tips, the safest route is to have your water tested and consult a professional. If the lead levels are high, you'll likely need to install a filter and potentially replace aging pipes. Support for Current Cast comes from the Mitsubishi Corporation Foundation for the Americas. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
In part one of our story, we met Carol Vanderwall, a resident of Bon Carbo, Colorado, a rural area in the southern part of the state, just above the New Mexico border.
Bon Carbo has seen intense gas drilling. Several residents, including Carol, have discovered that their water is contaminated, specifically with a chemical called tert-butyl alcohol, or TBA.
The state of Colorado's regulatory agency, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, or COGCC, won't link the contamination to the industry, even though many residents had baseline testing showing that the chemical wasn't there before drilling.
The TBA was found in nearly a quarter of homeowner wells and was also found in monitoring wells and even produced water, yet the COGCC published a report suggesting TBA in the Raton Basin was either from adhesives used to seal pipes or naturally occurring in the formation.
This is a striking conclusion, given that its author, Peter Gintadas, COGCC's environmental protection specialist for Southeast Colorado at the time, had told a homeowner the opposite, that TBA wasn't naturally occurring.
Oh, yeah. Well, I characterized it as an opinion rather than a scientific study.
That's Joel Nelson. He's a retired geologist who lives not far from Carol Vanderwall. He also has TBA in his water and said the report was just a hypothesis and not something that should be viewed as conclusive.
He couldn't prove that it was naturally occurring any more than I could prove that it's Pioneer's fault.
Pioneer is Pioneer Natural Resources, the predominant driller in the area. The report drew condemnation from residents who called it business as usual, referring to the COGCC as the Colorado Oil and Gas Cover-Up Commission, or even worse. Many people here firmly believe that COGCC's only interest is promoting oil and gas in the state.
So was this a good, solid scientific investigation by the agency? Or, as some have called it, a fluff piece meant to make the issue go away? To answer that question, we sought out scientists for an unbiased review. And where better to find them than at the very place they train geologists and petroengineers?
Hi, John.
Hi, thanks for meeting with us.
My name's John Spear. I'm in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the Colorado School of Mines in Golden, Colorado.
Professor Spear is one of a handful of scientists we asked to review the COGCC report. The Colorado School of Mines is an engineering and applied science research university with special expertise in the development of natural resources.
So what are your basic comments about the COGCC report?
My basic comments are that there is a lot of information there. A lot of it is well done. I also think that there are other things in there that could be in there that are missing.
Such as?
Such as, I think geochemistry is well represented there. There's a little bit of microbiology in there. What's missing to me is I would like to know more about the geology. I would also like to know, have a greater sample representation. Like they look at two frac flowback waters, for example. Why not look at like 30 or 50? And then why not compare that basin to waters coming from basins elsewhere, either in this state or going to adjacent states or even to across the country? I think those sort of things would help this.
One of the conclusions of the report is that a possible explanation is that the TBA found down there in the Raton Basin was caused by PVC pipe or sealants on the PVC pipe to people's water wells. And do you have any thoughts about that possible explanation?
I think there is some legitimacy to that possible explanation. I would like to have that report, which is not in that report, compared to other locations where PVC pipes are used either for drinking water distribution to an individual house, to other wells that are in other parts of this state. It would be nice to know, can they get a TBA reading from a groundwater well in Golden, Colorado that's installed the same way?
So I'm trying to get to the point whether they looked at enough PVC pipes in the area to determine whether that's a good explanation.
I would say they needed to look at more.
A second potential source the COGCC identified is that the TBA was formed as a chemical breakdown of isobutane. It should be noted that Pioneer Natural Resources also investigated this as a source of TBA when it first started appearing, but determined there wasn't a lot of isobutane in the Raton Basin.
That's a conclusion shared by the scientists we interviewed, including John Spear.
I would agree that isobutane conversion to T-butyl alcohol is not a very efficient process, either chemically or biologically. I think that's true. And time and energy are involved in that conversion, right? As well as the kind of microbe needs to be there that can do this conversion.
Would it be important to be able to know what frac fluids the driller was using?
Yes, I think it would be important to know what they were using in the compositions and in the concentrations. What are in those frac fluids? The industry is always a little iffy because there is some proprietary knowledge to what's in those frac fluids. My frac fluid works better than your frac fluid, and that's worth X amount of dollars. I get that. I understand that. But at the same time, I think we also need to know what's being injected into our subsurface, how much is able to come back out, and what are the long-term ramifications for that.
In COGCC's conclusions, the report states that, quote, based on all data available to this investigation, there is no indication that the source of TBA in the domestic water wells is recent CBM drilling, completion, or production operations.
This would give the impression that COGCC used every piece of information it could get its hands on to study the issue.
Only they didn't.
They did not take anything at all of all the reports that he has submitted.
That's John Dolores. He's talking about his hydrologist who has been sampling his water well for years.
Yeah, he's been sampling it since 2005. He did a baseline test before they even started drilling in this area.
In 2006, a well cap blowout near his home sent water geysering out of his domestic well. After the accident, Pioneer agreed to have the water tested, and his hydrologist continued to sample to find out if the incident impacted the water.
It was in their well that the TBA first started showing up.
So by the time COGCC went to write their report, There was over 10 years of data about the Dolores well, a wealth of information that would have added significantly to the study.
But according to the consultants we asked to review the report, COGCC did not include the data in their study, although it was available. COGCC did, however, use data supplied from Pioneer, the gas drilling company.
We brought the Dolores water well reports to show John Spear.
So it seems like that this kind of data should have been included in this kind of report, because this is more meat for the report.
It's a lot of data.
Yeah, it's a lot of data. If this wasn't included, then you have to ask why. There were a couple of indications in the overall report where I thought it was a little bit selective. Selective data was being applied. Another flaw of the report. Typically, the way we like to do scientific reports is you want to do a thorough literature search. You want to combine all that is known into one place and then start digesting that information. That's the way you should do a report.
As far as COGCC is concerned, this closes the matter.
I would say, in my mind, it opens the matter further. I would like to know more, and I think, you know, if this is truly a problem, and we don't know the health effects of TBA on people, there's not enough information known about that, but if I were the EPA, I would be wondering, or the CDPHE here in Colorado, I would be wondering about what are the health effects of this, and I think it warrants further study. I think this report opens the door to that.
We wanted to interview Peter Gintadas on the record about his report, but we were told that his preference was to address any specific questions in writing. We asked COGCC for a comment about our story, and they did not respond.
And as far as Carol Vanderwall, her complaint is still open, and she hasn't been contacted by COGCC for over a year and a half.
As an 81-year-old widow, she, like many of her fellow landowners, hauls water at her own expense from the nearest town 30 miles away because she worries her well water is unsafe to drink.
Reporting from Denver, Colorado, I'm Franny Halperin.
And I'm Jamie Sudler, and you're listening to H2O Radio.
And now our calendar of events. Tomorrow night, starting tomorrow night, the Permaculture Design Certification course that we heard about a few weeks ago when Steve Mann and Hillary Ann Noonan were on the program begins tomorrow night. It's from 6 to 9. It's a Kansas City Permaculture Education Extension and Research teaching a 12-week permaculture design certification course, non-residency, 72-hour course, fulfilling Bill Mollison's criteria for gaining design certification. The course will include group design exercises, self-study time, hands-on projects, visits to demonstration sites, and other learning activities. And so the lead instructors will be Steve Mann and Hillary Noonan, who we heard on the show, along with Michael Allman and Jeremy Rothakushel, if I hope I pronounced that. And the course will be February 23rd through May 14th on each Tuesday from 6 to 9 p.m. and Saturday field sessions from 9 a.m. till noon at Urban Farming Guys, 3700 East 12th Street here in Kansas City, Missouri. More information available at the Eco Radio KC Facebook page. On the February 23rd, which is also tomorrow, 6:30 to 9, Conservation Management Workshop, Wildlife and Native Plants Can Thrive on Small Acreages, Giving Nurturing Management, and that is at the Bass Pro Drive at Bass Pro Shops in Independence, Missouri. On the 25th, Bridging the Gaps, Environmental Business Network lunch will feature climate change, water wars, and other scary stuff with Dr. Wendell Christopher King, Dean of Academics at Fort Leavenworth and retired Brigadier General with the U.S. Army. The event will be at 11:30 to 1 at our Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center, 4750 Troost. More information at bridgingthegap.org. And the Backyard Chickens Keeping, exploring the basics of raising chickens in your backyard, including the benefits. That happens in Kingsville, Missouri. More at Powell Gardens. More info at powellgardens.com. And we're going to go out with the rest of our weekly This Week in Water.
In Rio, Olympic athletes will be competing to stay healthy. That and other stories for the week ending February 21st, 2016. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
If you're planning to compete in an open water swim or sailing event at the Olympics in Rio this summer, you're going to have to pack a lot of Listerine and hand sanitizer.
Rio de Janeiro's water, which has been polluted for years, will not be cleaned up in time for the Summer Olympics in about 6 months.
ESPN's Bonnie Ford took a look last week at the situation in an extensive report, and while planners and officials promised 7 years ago to remove about 80% of the sewage from city water, those initial goals will not be met.
An earlier Associated Press report found enough sewage was being dumped into water bodies where Olympic athletes will compete to create high levels of viruses and bacteria.
And that has Olympic committees around the world preparing their athletes to cope with polluted waters.
According to ESPN, most of the athletes said that competing in the water was not as upsetting as the thought of local people having to drink, swim, and bathe in it every day.
A Dutch Olympic windsurfer who competed in Rio in 2013 told ESPN that racers had to slalom through waters to avoid plastic garden chairs, a refrigerator, and even dead animals. He said it was better last December, but he is still disturbed by the conditions.
Some athletes are planning to take precautions such as wearing plastic overalls, receiving vaccinations, using loads of sanitizer, and taking fast and frequent showers after their races.
But after the athletes are gone, the people of Rio will still have no choice but to live with the polluted waters.
Last week, it rained about a half an inch in Los Angeles, and about 28 inches of snow fell in the Sierra Nevada mountains of California.
All of this precipitation was more than welcome, as February had so far turned out to be a bit of a bust.
This month is usually the wettest in California, but not one drop of water fell in Los Angeles or San Diego before last Wednesday.
In San Francisco, February usually brings over 3 inches of rain. However, even after last week's storm, the area had received about one-third of its usual moisture.
So the prospects for ending California's drought don't look good.
According to PolitiFact, an additional 80 inches of rain would have to fall in the northern Sierra before October on top of what has already occurred.
While the El Nino weather pattern is hoped to bring more moisture in March, the concern is that the phenomenon will transform into La Nina, bringing hotter and drier conditions.
Last week, a pipeline spilled an estimated 1,700 gallons of oil into a dry creek bed near Gillette, Wyoming. The Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality blamed the leak on internal corrosion.
The damaged pipeline is a gathering line that collects oil or natural gas from a well to bring it to a processing facility or tank miles away. These lines are different from big transmission pipelines that carry materials across the country.
According to the Government Accountability Office, the number of gathering lines has surged with the oil and gas boom, and in rural areas they are largely unregulated. In fact, state regulators in Wyoming only get involved when spills happen, and they have little to do with preventative maintenance.
The risk caused by leaking oil pipelines were highlighted last Wednesday when the federal government announced that corrosion was the cause of the spill near Santa Barbara, California last year. That pipeline break caused more than 140,000 gallons of oil to leak, killing hundreds of birds and mammals.
Local lawmakers say the problem stemmed from how the pipeline was regulated. Initially, it was under federal regulation as an interstate line because it was intended to carry crude to Texas. The part from California to Texas was not completed, but the line was never moved under more strict state and local regulations, which would have required regular safety inspections. At the present time, no one would recommend that you drink water from a faucet in Flint, Michigan. Tap water there is still laced with lead, but it also contains the very bitter taste of irony.
A study published last week shows that Flint water customers were paying the highest water bills of 500 communities across the U.S.
Food and Water Watch concluded that residents of the troubled city paid rates almost 3 times the national average.
In August last year, a state judge ordered the city to roll back water and sewer rates by 35% and stop a monthly service charge. Still, some would argue the rate is much too high a price to pay for lead-poisoned water.
The irony dripping out of Flint faucets gets even stronger as attention was renewed last week on the fact that Nestle, the giant food corporation, draws water out of Michigan aquifers at the rate of more than 200 gallons a minute.
According to Democracy Now!, Nestle is not required to pay anything to extract the water, beside a small permitting fee to the state and the cost of leases to a private landowner.
Additionally, Nestle received $13 million in tax breaks from the state to locate the plant in Michigan.
And finally this week, speaking of drinking water, we're told we should stay hydrated when flying, especially on long flights to avoid getting jet lag or catching a cold.
But what to drink became a hot topic on the website Reddit recently. People who claim to have worked for airlines suggested that you should think twice about accepting that onboard coffee.
The EPA began investigating the safety of water on airplanes in 2004 after discovering that 15% of planes tested positive for coliform bacteria in their drinking water systems.
By 2012, as many as 12% of the planes still tested positive, but there has not been any reported case of a person getting sick from airplane water.
The Huffington Post wanted to find out if the water was safe, so they asked Abby Unger, a former flight attendant and current motivational speaker.
She said that while it's true the water tanks are not clean, they're filled only with potable water. That water may not make for the greatest cup of coffee, but it's not unsafe.
Still, when that beverage cart comes down the aisle, you might want to go for a soda or even a Bloody Mary, or just maybe grab a Starbucks in the terminal. This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Sustainable water management means more than just conservation. Learn more at awwa.org/sustainable16.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.